This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
I know that it's an easy shiur because it's a shiur that I gave to a group of non-Jewish people recently, and they understood it very easily. Not because they're less intelligent, but without having the Torah background, the fact that they grasped it with ease means that it's not too complex. But particularly what was interesting in that particular occasion was that among them was a man who came up to me afterwards and said, I just want to tell you that he gave me a rough time during the talk. He interrupted a lot of times with some very good questions. And then he came up, and I thought he was quite hostile. Then he came up and he said, I just want to tell you that I had decided to emigrate. He was a managing director of a large company. He said, and in listening to you, I've changed my mind. Not that the talk had anything to do with emigration. He said, everybody's told me it's going to come right here, but nobody's told me how. Today I understand how. So I thought, once that's the case, I might as well tell the same thing to the people in my own base of Medrash. Those of them who've turned up. It's quite amazing. I've commented to a number of people. I don't know if it's very good, this thing that I do with the Institute of Business Ethics. Because I get it's like a little bit like with Yonah and going to Nineveh, and one of the reasons he didn't want to go is because he felt it would be a time to the Yidden. How receptive the goyim would have been to his words, and that they would have accepted the Musa, and they would have done tshuva, and that could have been a tainah to the Yidden. It's difficult. When I give a talk to the goyim, I give them maybe, each time I talk to them, maybe a fifth. I doubt that it's even anywhere near a fifth of what I give to a Motzei Shabbos shiur. I don't think it's anywhere near a fifth, about a fifth. And they pay the institute, that's how we pay our way, they pay the institute 4,000 or 5,000 rand a time, just to listen to a fifth of what the Olam here gets every Motzei Shabbos. And some come, some don't bother to come, some send tapes, some listen to tapes, they complain that the tape costs 4 rand, or how much are we charging for the tapes now? 10 rand, what is that? 10 rand. that's already... Absolutely, definitely. And there was one fellow who was there, there was a television producer who was in one of these sessions, who said he wants to make a video, 15 minutes. I said, yes, but to make a 15 minute video, you need a long time. You can't just sit for 15 minutes. I don't have the time to put into it. You need a week to make a 15 minute video. He said, we'll pay you 10,000 rand a day for the week. No problem. But for a 15 minute video to say something which is a quarter of a fifth of what you've done in the Motzei Shabbos shiur. So it's a taina. It's a taina we have in the Yidden. What can we do? No, I'm just going to start charging. That's all. The Medrash Tanchuma says, on the beginning of Parshas Noach, Ze echod mishloisho sherou gimel oilomus. Noach is one of three people who saw three worlds. What are the three worlds? Well, who are the three people? Noach was one of them. Daniel was another one. And Iyov was the third. Three people in the Tanakh who saw three worlds. What are the three? Noach. Ra'o oilam b'yeshuvo, he saw the world settled. V'ra'ohu b'churbono, and he saw the world in destruction and chaos. V'chozo v'ra'ohu b'yeshuvo, and again he saw it in its established. After the flood, he saw it being established again. So he saw the world go through these three phases, and he lived right through it all, and was a party, was party to the whole transformation. That's Noach, Daniel. Ro'o binyan bayis rishon, he saw the building of the first Beis HaMikdash, when it was there. V'ra'ohu chorev, he saw it in its destructed, in its destroyed state. the Chazal v'Ra'ol Bonoi, and he saw it rebuilt again. Vinyan Bas Bayisheni, when the second Beis Hamikdash was built. Iyev, Ro'ol Binyan Beisoi, Iyev saw the building up of his family, v'Chur Bonoi, and its destruction. V'Chazal v'Ra'ol B'Yeshuva, and once again he saw his family rebuilt. Noach, I understand, he saw three worlds. He saw a world before the flood, he saw the world during the flood, he saw the world after the flood. The world looked very different. Each of these three worlds were very different. The world before the flood, the world during the flood was just water and the ark, and the world after the flood was just his family and slowly the repopulation of the world. He saw all that taking place. Three completely different phases. He saw the world through in three different situations, totally different. Daniel, the world was much the same. Beis HaMikdash was different. Beis HaMikdash in Yerushalayim, then he saw the Beis HaMikdash destroyed, then he saw the Beis HaMikdash again. I would understand if it said, Ro'o Yerushalayim in three ways. Saw three phases of Yerushalayim, saw three phases of the Jewish people. But to talk about the world, three worlds he saw, that means the difference between each one is the same as the difference between one world and another. Imagine if they found some kind of life on Mars. That's the difference between one oilum and the other. Three oilumas. It doesn't even say three phases of the evolution of the world. It doesn't say three stages in the world's development. It says three oilumas. Each one was a separate world completely. And just as the world before the flood was totally different to the world during the flood and to the world after the flood, so the world before the destruction of the first temple, during the destruction of the first temple, and during the second temple were three different oilumas. They were three different worlds. And the third one's hardest of all, Eev. So his family being built, his family being destroyed, his family rebuilt. Okay, it's a big thing for a man to go through. It had a terribly tragic life. But that's not three worlds. That's his own life. Went through three phases, but that's not three worlds. It's not him alone on this. But what we see here are three entirely different cultures operating. Three entirely different ways of relating to the oil. Three entirely different ways of seeing the oil. The first one is Noach's way. Noach sees the Olam objectively. So what is Noach's world? Noach's world is that world out there. That's his world. That's his Olam. Nature, science, humanity. That's his world. The animals, the Olam. The objective world is the Olam of Noach. And he saw his world being built up. He saw his world destroyed, and he saw his world being rebuilt. And what was the world of Daniel? The world of Daniel was not the world of the outside. The world of Daniel was not the world of science and technology. The world of Daniel was not the world of the environment. The world of Daniel was the world of Torah. The world of Daniel was the world of Avodah, of Avodah Hashem, of Kedusha, of the Avodah Space Hamikdash. That was the world of Daniel. The rest of the world was secondary to that. The rest of the world was just the backdrop to that. The Olam was the Beis HaMikdash in Daniel's life. And he saw the Olam destroyed. He saw his world destroyed in just the same way as Noah saw his world destroyed. The destruction of the Beis HaMikdash to Daniel was the same as the destruction of the world to Noah. Exactly the same impact it had on him. Exactly the same effect it had on him. And Eve? What was Eve's world? Eve's world was his family. That was his Olam. His world wasn't the big world outside, although he was involved in business. Eve was a wealthy man. But that wasn't his world. That wasn't the center of his life. The center of his life was his family. That's what he lived for. Everything else was there to serve his family. Just as in Daniel's life, everything was there to serve Hashem, and everything was there to serve Kedusha and to serve the Beis HaMikdash, so for Eve, everything was there to serve his family. And when he saw his family destroyed, he saw the center of his world destroyed. He saw the legs upon which his world stood. He saw those legs being removed. That's what he saw, taken away. Like the Mishnah says, that one of the three legs that the world stands on is Avodah, the service of the Beis HaMikdash. Take away, it doesn't say one of four legs, one of three legs. Because if you remove one of four legs, the table can still stand. If you remove one of three legs, the table can't still stand. So in Daniel's life, it's true. It's only the Beis HaMikdash that was destroyed. That's all. Beis HaMikdash. One building was destroyed. It just happens to be that building was holding up the world. So when that world was destroyed, Daniel's entire world collapses. And the same with Eeyore. Eeyore functioned in the wider world, but the leg of that table, one of the legs that held up the world, one of the three legs that held up Eeyore's world, was his own family. And when he lost his family, he lost his world. There was no more meaning to life. There was nothing to work for. There was nothing to go out for. That was his life had collapsed. So we see three completely different types of individuals, three different types of cultures as to how they're relating. What constitutes their olam? What constitutes their world in these three cases? And these three cultures, we develop much further. Let's look at the first culture, at the Noach culture. The Noach culture, their world is the objective world. Things outside, objects. Now what is similar, what is common between all the cultures operating is that they all serve, they all have avoda. Every culture serves something. Every culture believes in something. And the question is what they believe in. There's avoda sakodesh and there's avoda zoro, but there's no culture without avoda. There's no culture that doesn't serve something. Noah's culture serves what? It serves the object. It serves the world outside. So what is a culture that serves the world outside? In other words, it serves perfection. All three cultures serve perfection. Because all three cultures believe in a God of some sort. Everybody believes in a God of some sort. And what is a God? God is perfection. The question is perfection of what? That's where cultures differ from one another. You look at the Chinese, or you look at the Europeans, or you look at the Africans, or whoever you want to look at the Jews, at the Arabs, everybody worships perfection. Everybody admires perfection. That's common among all cultures. The question is, where do we seek that perfection? In the culture of Noach, whose world was the Olam, and when that world got destroyed, everything was destroyed? After all, was everything really destroyed? Noach's family wasn't destroyed, so if Noach was an Eeyore, he would have been very happy. All I lost is my wealth, fine. The world is lost, fine. Everything's gone, fine. But my family is intact. Eeyore would have relished to be in Noach's situation. And Daniel? If Daniel just didn't have to see the Beis HaMikdash destroyed, let the Olam be destroyed. Who cares about the Olam? As long as the Beis HaMikdash is there. He would have been quite happy to be floating around in an ark as long as the Beis HaMikdash was watertight. But to Noach, this was a terrible time. Noach tried to get out of the ark. He wasn't comfortable in the Teva at all. He didn't like it. It was a terrible time of suffering. And to see this destruction of the world and the depression when he comes afterwards, when he drinks his glass of wine, that's all part of his depressiveness, of his state of misery caused by the destruction of the world. Because he seeks perfection in the Olam. And his world, his God had been destroyed. Not that he didn't believe in the Ribbono Shel Olam. Of course he believes in the Ribbono Shel Olam. But the manifestation of God's perfection to a Noach is the perfection of the world, the perfection of the environment. And this kind of culture believes in the perfection of the environment. And it seeks zero defect in the environment, in technology and in all the things around it. Seeks absolute technological perfection. So a person from this culture, for example, they build, when it comes to davening, they've got to pray. Where do they pray? They pray in magnificent cathedrals and temples. They build these magnificent structures that are perfect in their sense of balance, in their architecture, in their aesthetic appeal. They build this absolute perfection. They try and achieve perfect acoustics. Terribly important to them to have perfect acoustics, because that's part of that perfection in their environment. If they come into their places of worship and they aren't aesthetically perfect, and they aren't architecturally perfect and electronically and engineeringly perfect, it bothers them no end, because they see imperfection around them and that disturbs their religious feelings. These are people who could be listening to perfect music, but if there's the slightest crackle on their hi-fi set, they get terribly irritated, because they're not listening to the music, they're listening to perfection of hi-fi technology. That's what they're listening to. And if they've just invested 10,000 rand in a hi-fi set, and they're listening to it, and there's a little bit of a whir in the background that you've got to really listen to hard, and the only time you hear it is in those fractions of a second when the orchestra is absolutely quiet. Just that moment when everything stopped. And if you listen carefully, you'll hear that whir in the background, which is nowhere near as irritating as the coughing and the crackling of, of sweet paper that you'll hear in a real concert hall, that's something else. But in my hi-fi set that I've just spent 10,000 rand on to be able to hear this word, and then he reads in the latest hi-fi magazine that they've developed one for another 10,000 rand that gets rid of that thing, and then he starts figuring out how he's going to get the new one, and he gets all aggravated that his old one is already out of fashion. And so with his computer, the same thing. He's already got a computer that is capable of doing a million times more than he has any need for whatever. It's a million times the speed of anything he has any need for whatever. But if he's just bought, as inevitably happens, and 2 months later the new version comes out that can do it a billion times more than he needs and quicker than he needs, he gets irritated. Why? Because he's seeking perfection in objects. And he thinks he's acquired perfection, and he's thrilled with the perfection he's acquired, and then, believe it or not, they come out with a new model. One of the reasons that Mercedes-Benz has a wonderful resale value is the same reason as Rolex watches have a wonderful resale value, and that is because they don't change the model that often. And so also people feel secure. They find something perfect, and they're not going to come out with a new model 2 weeks later. That's why people invest that kind of money in it. Something that stays for a while. It doesn't go out of fashion that quickly. Different marketing techniques. People get very aware as the Japanese work on the other part of people. They say, we'll rather make our cars cheaper and we'll make them buy new ones every year. Because every year we'll come out with something better, and they'll get so irritated with the one they've just bought they won't be able to resist buying the new one. It's two different kinds of marketing tactics. One is more honest than the other. But it's two different appeals to different things in people. But people like to find perfection and to maintain and to hang on to that perfection. And as we discussed in last night's drosha, this kind of excellence and this kind of perfection is a matter of comparison. It's a matter of contrasting. So that if one finds something which today is perfect, it doesn't help tomorrow. When my wife says to me, but what do you want a new computer for? Yesterday you were quite so happy with yours. What's changed since yesterday? Has your computer gone inferior since yesterday? No. Has it broken down since yesterday? No. Is there something you want to do with it today that you can't do because it's inadequate? No. So what's gone wrong with it? The only thing that's gone wrong with it is there's a better one out. That's all. And in comparison to that, mine doesn't look so good anymore. That's all. So this kind of perfection is a perfection we admire, not because of its inherent value and its intrinsic value, but because of the way it is shown up against the backdrop of mediocrity. That's the kind of perfection that this culture worships, that this culture strives for. And this culture it worships aesthetics, beauty, art, and it finds perfection in that art. And so you'll find that the Greeks working out, for example, the perfect proportions of aesthetics. The golden rectangle, exactly what length and what height a perfect rectangle should be. Where in a frame the main object should be in order to have aesthetic perfection. A perfect face, how far the eyes should be apart from one another in relationship to the rest of the face. Where the nose should be, how big the nose should be, how big the mouth should be. And if you look at Greek statues, you will see perfect perfection. The only thing that you ask yourself is, if it's so perfect, why did the Ribbono Shel Olam never make anybody like that? So why does Hashem never make people with such perfection? But they have developed absolute systems and formulae and mathematical relationships of perfection. And this kind of culture in its music will go for perfect kind of music, Baroque kind of music, the Bachy kind of music, with perfect mathematical relationships between the notes and the chords. Absolute perfection. That's their kind of culture. That's their kind of civilization. Can you hear me at the back? Sorry? Can you hear at the back there? I was going to say, you can't hear. The second culture is the culture of Daniel. What is Daniel's culture? Oh, that's a bit better. What is Daniel's culture? He finds perfection in the Beis HaMikdash. What does that mean, he finds perfection in the Beis HaMikdash? Has it gone quiet because you're closing the windows, or did you turn off the rain actually? Daniel finds perfection in the Beis HaMikdash. That means he understands the world isn't perfect. The environment isn't perfect. He doesn't expect his hi-fi set to be perfect. He's not going to invest another 10,000 rand in a newer hi-fi set just to get it perfect. He doesn't mind that a newer model motor car has come out with some kunst that his old one doesn't have. That never bothered Daniel at all. As long as the Beis HaMikdash was perfect, that's all.
Avodah had to be perfect, the Kohen Gadol had to be perfect, the Ribono Shel Olam was perfect, the Torah was perfect, that's it. If he wants to experience perfection, he goes to Yerushalayim and he goes to the Beis HaMikdash. That's his perfection, that's Daniel, that's his world, that's his whole Olam. So when we talk about the destruction of Noach's world, we're not just talking about the destruction of his world, we're talking about the destruction of God's manifestation of perfection as perceived by Noach. The world, which was the Ribono Shel Olam's picture of perfection in Noach's eyes, is gone. To Daniel, when the Beis HaMikdash was gone, that was his picture of perfection. His whole relationship with the Ribono Shel Olam was altered. Where does he experience that kind of perfection? Where does he find a place for worship? Where does he find a place where he can relate to that perfection, which is the Ribono Shel Olam manifested in the Beis HaMikdash as he saw it? This is a different culture altogether. This is a culture that worships perfection in a model. A model of perfection, the Ribono Shel Olam, the Torah, different kind of perfection. And it examines how close reality comes to the model, but it understands that it won't find reality in the model itself. It'll never find that. It won't find perfection in reality. It finds perfection in the model. And the model never really works perfectly except in the Beis HaMikdash. There are very few places where the environment is sufficiently controlled to allow that perfection to function. That's what the Beis HaMikdash is. That's for Daniel what it is. And this culture is different altogether. This culture worships perfection in the model, as we've said. So it worships ideas, values, philosophies, and so on. In the first culture that I discussed, you'll see that there's no humanity really. It's a culture that worships perfection in the object, but not in people. People don't come into that culture at all. Just as when they're listening to music, they're not listening to music, they're listening to the perfection of their hi-fi set. So when they're relating to people, they're not relating to people, they're relating to perfection in social organizations. It's a different kind of thing altogether. And they're capable of terrible violence. They're capable of terrible cruelty because there's no humanity. Since there's no humanity in it, they can kill people, they can murder people, they can wipe people out, it doesn't matter. Provided they design the most perfect system to do it. The gas chambers have to work perfectly, and the crematoria have to work perfectly, and production level have to be kept at a certain rate in order to achieve that perfection of production. It's all set up, it's inevitable that society can come with the greatest of ease into developing a little bit further its worship of perfection into the annihilation of races if necessary. If it feels it will make the world a better place, a more perfect place to do that. What about the second culture? The culture that worships the model. Let's look at Daniel's culture, at ours. There, there's perfection in the model. Is there humanity there? Well, yes, so we've after the Recha Kamoichol and that kind of thing the Torah says that we must do. But that love of humanity is also a dangerous idea, because if it's not understood properly, why do we love other people? Because the Torah says we must. Not because we really do. Because the Torah says, good, I love the Ribono Shel Olam, whatever it is. It's like you find in some German Machzorim for Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, you'll find it gives instructions. At this point you must do this, and at this point you must do this. You find in some of them, at this point you must cry. So sort of when you read this, at this point you must cry. Finish, then you carry on davening. It's you're turning it on and turning it off. You can have a kind of a compulsive relationship. You must love him. Good. Now I must love him. To love my neighbor as myself. Now I love you. Right. Finish loving. I can go on with my learning. I can carry on learning Torah. It's davening time. Can I stop loving you now? I'm finished with that mitzvah. I'm busy with another mitzvah. It can become compulsive to the point where it's also inhuman. There's also no guarantee of humanity. So this culture isn't violent. It isn't cruel. Unless it's doing so for the Ribono Shel Olam, of course. If it's fighting a holy war, then it can be just as cruel. It can also destroy people. And then there's the third culture. There's the culture of Eve. Eve is a much more intimate culture. Isn't it the family? It's a different kind of culture altogether. And that we call the culture of perfection in relationships. Not perfection in the object, and not perfection in a model, but perfection in relationships. As long as the relationship is good, it doesn't matter what else happens. And so they're not interested, this culture is not interested in massive big places of worship. As long as they feel good when they're communicating with the Ribono Shel Olam, that's fine, that's okay. They're not interested in the perfection of the hi-fi set, nor are they even interested in the perfection of the music they're listening to. The hi-fi set doesn't have to be perfect, and the music doesn't have to be Bach, as long as they feel good when they're listening to it. Are you beginning to recognize the culture? It's got to create a good feeling in them. Culture of relationships. As long as the relationship, as long as the vibe is good, then everything's okay. Let's take these three cultures a step further, and then you'll see the picture emerging very, very carefully. Noach's three sons. Who have we got in Noach's three sons? We've got Yefes. Yefes means beauty. Yefes means perfection in the object. That's what beauty is. Aesthetic perfection is perfection in things outside, things beyond oneself. And we have Shem. Shem means definition, to name things, to define things. That's the model, to create perfection of definition, to create theoretical models which are perfect, and then to understand that there is a gap between reality and the model, and to try and narrow the gap as far as one can. That's Shem. And then we come to Cham, which means warm. He's warm, he's intimate, he's a different kind of Bria altogether. That's Cham, and Cham is the warm, he finds perfection in relationships. That's all. Provided there's a perfection in the relationship, the other areas of perfection are not that important to him. And so his art and culture becomes very, very sensual. It's very basic. It must create a feeling. As long as he's feeling good, then it's okay. That's satisfactory. So these three cultures that we see expressed in this Medrash Tanchuma, we also see expressed in the three sons of Noach, and we see them united in some sense in Noach himself. So if we look at what was happening in the Teva, we had three very different cultures, never mind different families. The family of Noach, on the one hand, and then the families of Shem, Cham, and Yofes, on the other hand, not only were they different families, but they were three completely different cultures that operated in different ways, that saw things in different ways, whose world were different worlds. For Shem, the world had not been destroyed, because the world of ideas existed. The flood didn't wipe out the world of ideas. For Shem, the world wasn't destroyed. For Cham, also the world didn't have to be destroyed, depending on how he felt, but it was a little bit heavy in the table there. There wasn't that much chance for entertainment, there wasn't that much chance for levity, it was quite a serious atmosphere in the table. So poor old Cham probably suffered a little bit in the table. And Yefes also. Yefes, with his total belief in technology and the world around him, good, the world now became his table. That was all where he could find perfection. The rest of the big wide world had been wiped out, so it must have been hard for Yefes too. So Shem is the only one there who actually goes through the experience without an enormous amount of suffering. He's the only one whose world has not been totally annihilated. What happens when they come out of the table? Vayu v'nei Noach hayotzi min ha-teva, the b'nei Noach came out of the ark, Shem v'chom v'yofes. When they're listed right in the beginning of the Torah, we're told that Noach had three sons, Shem, Eschom, the Es Yofes. The Vov, the and, is only on the last one, which is like normal English or Hebrew. He has A, B, and C. When they came out of the table, it's Shem, and Chom, and Yefes. Three different cultures, each one in its own right. And Chom, the Chom who Avi Chanoan, was the father of Canaan. Now Canaan was such a degenerate nation already at the time that the Torah was given, of course, that we were instructed when we got to Israel to wipe them out. And there was no way that our Ovis wanted their children to marry the descendants of Canaan. So already Canaan was a very degenerate nation, and the Torah says that degeneracy relates back to Chom already. Shloisho ele b'nei Noach, these three were the sons of Noach, ume ele noftzo chol ha'oretz, and from them came the whole world. So all the cultural differences, all the cultures we have operating in the world today have at their roots these three cultures. Of course, there are many more than three cultures today because we're dealing with different combinations. A bit of this and a bit of that, and they're made up in different ways. Some cultures are 90% Yefes with 5% Shem and 5% Chom, and some cultures are 80% Shem with 10% Yefes and 10% Chom or whatever. Each one has a different makeup. But one begins to recognize the effects of these three primary cultures in all the cultures operating today as we know them. Vayochel Noach Isho Adomo Vayitakor. And Noach, the man of the earth, began to, and he planted a keren. That was the first thing he did. He planted a vineyard when he came out. And you know the story, Vayesh min hayayin, later on the vineyard gave grapes, he made wine. Vayishkor, he got a little drunk. Vayisgal b'seich oholoi, and he lay down in his tent, not properly covered. And Chazal tell us, Rashi brings it, the criticism against him is not just that he got drunk. The criticism against him is Vayochel. Says Rashi, what does Vayochel mean? Also Atzmo Chulin means two things. Number one, it comes from the word Chol. He defiled himself. He made himself secular. Why? He should have planted something else first. Nothing wrong with planting vineyards. You need wine. You need them for korbanos. You need them for kiddush on Shabbos. You need it. There's nothing wrong with planting wine. Nothing wrong with having a glass of wine occasionally, as David HaMelech says, and we discussed it in earlier shirim. V'yayin yisamach l'vavenosh. Feeling a bit miserable, you want to have a little schnapps to perk yourself up a little bit, it's okay, not the end of the world. That's not the criticism. The criticism is that the first thing he plants is the vine. First thing he does. Shouldn't it have been first? And the Medrash is more specific. The Medrash records that he had with him saplings for fig trees and olive trees. Why did he start with the grapes? And how do we understand it? Why did he start with the grapes? And what's wrong with starting with the grapes? What's wrong with it is that what must have motivated him? He's miserable. The world is desolate. He's despairing. He's depressed. Look around, there's nothing. Just imagine that. People were depressed after the Holocaust. Imagine what one would feel if one family survived in the entire world. There's nothing. There are no factories, there are no farms, there are no other people. There's nothing. In the entire world, there's you and your family. That's it. No matter where you'll go, no matter how far you'll travel, you won't see another person. And you're left entirely to your own resources. It's very, very depressing. It's very, very overbearing. And so he felt the need to be able to create almost an escape from that depressiveness. What is he doing? He's treating the symptom. He's not treating the cause. The cause is that the world is desolate. So do something about it. Start with olives and with bread and with all the things the world needs. Get busy. Grapes as well. Nothing wrong with planting vineyards too, but not Vayachal. Not first. First, treat the cause. And the symptomatic treatment you can do is an aside later on. But don't start off treating symptoms. And what is he doing? What kind of symptomatic treatment is he using? Look, the world is so desolate. What's left for me but to drink a glass of wine? What's that going to do? It will create a pleasant sensation. So out of the three cultures operating within Noach as one human being, the fact that these three cultures all came out from him means that he contains them all within himself. In Noach there was a Shem. In Noach there was a Yefes. In Noach there was a Chom. He comes out of the Teva. And what's the first characteristic he expresses of his three sons? Does he say, "Oi, the world's in a terrible state, let's sit down and learn some Gemara and cheer ourselves up"? Does he say, "Oi, the world's in a terrible state, let's start building"? He says, "Oi, the world's in a terrible state, let's have a drink. What's we going to do? Let's have something to drink." That's Chom. Right after the flood, the first thing he does is he gives strength to the Chom inside him. And the result of that is that Chom responds to him. Of all the sons, the only one who responds to him is Chom in a very negative way. Vayar Chom avi chanan es ervas oviv vayaged lishnei echov b'chutz. Chom saw, now there's a dispute among Chazal what he actually did. But Chazal learned, and Rashi brings it, that what he did was actually that he sterilized his father. And the reason that he did that, he saw his father was drunk, he thought that's a good opportunity. And the reason that he did that is, he says, this was the first time that birth control was used to control the population growth. Chom was very worried about the population growth. It's absolutely true. Umero Chom Shesirso. What got into Chom to do such a thing? Amaloyim Leechov. Odom Arishun Shnei Bolim Hoyuloiva Horag Zed Zebish Vil Yurushas Hailam. Odom had two sons, and the one killed the other because of the question of who would inherit the world from their father. Vavinu yesh legimel bonim. Our father has three. Already a big population. This. Vodena mevakish ben levin. He wants fourth. He wants to increase the world population by another 30%. That's we can't have that kind of thing. So this business of we need to cut down the world population didn't start when the world got overpopulated. Overpopulation is simply a perception problem. It's not a real problem. because overpopulation, as we've often discussed, is not a function of how many people there are in the world. It's a function of how productive the people in the world are. If we're dealing with unproductive people, then one person is already is overpopulated, because that one person is going to rape the world, he's going to destroy the world. If he's an unproductive person, he's consuming more than he's producing, and he'll destroy the world. And if they're productive people, if they are people who are producing more than they're consuming, what difference does it make how many there are? If people are productive, the more the better. Doesn't make any difference. When we're looking at the question of population explosion and population growth and the need to curb population growth, what we're really looking at is what are we to do about the growth in unproductive population. So what are we saying? What should we do about the growth in unproductive population? The answer should be is we should find ways to make them productive. What is the answer we're saying? Cut the population. And which population gets cut? Not the unproductive population. The productive population is the one that gets cut. It's so stupid. When you look at it, one actually can't figure out how the world can get itself on a roller coaster of a philosophical practice which is so erroneous, which is so stupid, which is so incorrect, and addressing the wrong problem with the wrong solution among the wrong people. It's just completely chaotic. Absolutely wrong. It's like saying, oh, you know, we have a patient here with cancer. Let's get the medicine that cures flu and let's give it to that fellow outside there. What's the one going to do with the other? It's the wrong medicine for the wrong disease administered on the wrong people. And we carry on with it. Chong's worried about the population explosion. Ah, there are now four people in the world, you know. The world's not enough place. And there are three of us, and our father wants a fourth one still, another child. Where's he going to fit in? Can't have this thing. We must sterilize him. What does that show Noach when Noach comes around? For a son in a world this big that's now depopulated totally, that's open to them, what does it show? What does it say about the one who wants to sterilize? What does it say about the one who wants to curb population growth? That's a person who doesn't understand the principle of productivity. That's what it means. Noach's response to Canaan is not because of he humiliated him. That's not why. His response to Canaan is not just because he sterilized him, because he caused the suffering. Noah desperately wanted to have another child, and Chom made it impossible for him. It's not taking it out on Chom for that. There were other ways he could have punished him for that. This isn't a punishment, it's a klolo, it's a curse. It's merely saying to him, I see what you are. You're a person who doesn't understand what it is to make a contribution. You're a person who doesn't understand that wealth doesn't have to be taken from somebody. Wealth can be created. That productivity can be made. That's what it is. And if that's the situation, if that's how it is, then you must be an Eved. An Eved is an unproductive person. An Eved is a person who's simply told what to do. He's a machine. He sells his labor. That's all. He enables other people to be productive with their minds so that the Eved can do the labor for the person. That's what an Eved is. You have revealed by the fact that you see a solution to the problem lying in sterilization rather than in productivity. You've revealed yourself to be an Eved, and you will be an Eved forever. You'll be a slave. And if we look further in the Torah, we see, the Torah tells us, Ve'eli told us b'dei Noach, these are the generations of Noach, Shem, Chom, v'Yofes, and they had children after the flood. B'nei Yefes, who were the children of Yefes? Goimer, Magog, Modai, Yovan, Vatuval, Umeshech, Vatiras, Ashkenaz, Europe, Greece, that all comes from Yefes. Chom, who were the children of Chom? Cush, Mitzrayim, Ethiopia, Egypt. So Europe becomes populated by the descendants of Yefes. Africa becomes populated by the descendants of Chom. And the Middle East becomes populated with the descendants of Shem, the Jews and the Arabs. And those are the civilizations that then move out. And what do we find, in fact? We find that the contributors to the world have been Shem and Yefes. What is the world contribution? Greece, Rome, the European cultures have given the world philosophy, and art, and literature, and education, and science and technology. That's all come from Yefes. And religion, and values, and morality, that's all come from, and conceptualization, mathematics, that's all come from Shem. And what has Chom given the world? What has Africa given the world? It's just as old a civilization as anything else, apart from AIDS. What is South Africa given the world? What has Africa given the world? Absolutely nothing. It's as old a civilization as the others. It's had as much chance as the others to develop, and it has developed its own cultures. But what contribution has it made? It's developed its own culture. It's developed its own civilization. And it has its own values. But what impact has it had on the rest of the world? What has it taught the world? What has it given the world? Nothing. That's Chom. It hasn't given the world anything, and it won't give the world anything. But I'm not altogether right. Because what is America? Is America Shem? Is America Yefes? Is America Chom? What is America? Europe is clearly Yefes, absolutely clear. Yefes with an input of Shem. It's Yefes with some religion. And it varies in different parts of Europe, but you see that very clearly. The Semitic races, the Jews and the Arabs, clearly Shem. It's clear as anything. What is America? There's a very lovely book written by Robert Persig, I think his name was, the fellow who wrote Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. I didn't read that book, but I read his new book. And he starts off with a beautiful section where he's investigating a Red Indian community for social anthropological purposes, and he's looking at these Red Indians, and a few things strike him. Their openness, their naivety, their simplicity, their childlike simplicity, and their total genuineness. Absolutely, everything's genuine. There's no imitation of anything. Whatever they've got is them. They're not trying to put on airs. They're not trying to imitate anybody else. It's their society, their culture, they're unapologetic about, and he's admiring this as he goes on. But there's one thing he can't figure out. It all looks so familiar. And then he realizes from the movies. They speak the same kind of English that the cowboys in the movies do, the plains accents, and the way they walk and the way they talk. It's not just the language, it's the style, it's the way they do things. And I can't figure this out. If there are people who are so absent of any form of imitation, how come they've imitated the Americans, the white Americans of that particular area? And he goes on exploring, and it's bothering him and bothering him, because the more he delves, the more he's satisfied that they don't imitate, and the more he's sure each nuance, each action he sees, each little expression, each movement he sees, it rings a bell. He's seen it before. He's seen it among the white Americans. So where do they get it from? Are they copying the whites? All of a sudden the penny drops. They're not copying the whites. The whites have copied them. American civilization is based on Red Indian culture, says he, and a mixture of European culture. And he says, and that's why the Europeans look at the Americans and they say they're naive and they're childish and they're sensual, which is exactly the same way the Americans look at the Red Indians. So if you look at an American from a European perspective, the description is the same as Americans give Red Indians. And what do the Americans think of Europeans? They're cold and they're objective and they're scientific and they're non-involved, which is exactly the description you'll hear from Red Indians about Americans. So the Red Indians see the Americans as... I think I've mentioned to you in some of the work that we've done where we've discovered something that people have always suspected, but we've actually worked it out scientifically exactly in terms of the ratios, that black people are very, very loyal in many cases to the companies they work for. But if the loyalty to the company they work for conflicts with the loyalty to fellow black people, the loyalty to the company drops to zero. And that's not because they're unethical. In other words, if I see my fellow, my mate, stealing, and I've now got to decide, do I report it to the company or don't I? I won't report it to the company if I'm a regular black man working. Why not? Very simply, the company is an object. It's a thing. It's a Western concept. It doesn't belong to anybody. No real people. It's got millions of rands. Nobody's going to notice the difference. Whereas if I report this man for stealing, he's got a real family. He's got children to feed. He's going to be without a job. I will not take responsibility to deprive his children of food because I owe some kind of ethical responsibility to this conglomerate of paperwork that doesn't mean a thing in human terms. So there's a very strong human element there. So what has America done wrong? Very simply, America has said to themselves, either consciously or subconsciously, I don't know, we have three cultures operating. We've got Yefes, we've got Shem, we've got Chom. We need to give expression to all three. So fine, we'll do that. And the way we do it is as follows. In business and in the professions and in science and technology, we only use Yefes. So when you come into a business environment or when you come into a scientific environment, there is only one thing to do. and that is perfection in the object. And everything else is subservient to perfection in the object. Bottom line performance and absolute technological perfection, beating the competition, nothing else counts. There are no other loyalties, there are no other relationships, there is no other religion, nothing else counts when you're in business other than business. That's it. But when you go home, then you can be, well, let's say before you come home, when you go to shul or to church, lahavdil, then it's shame. You've got to be kind, you've got to be fair, you've got to be good, you've got to give charity, you've got to be charitable, you've got to be shame. And in law also, we have an American constitution that's like a Bible, a perfect model, can't be tampered with. You have tremendous respect, you give respect to the judge, the same respect as you give to a Kohen, and to the chief justice you give the same respect that you give to a Kohen Gadol, and to a policeman you give the same respect that you give to a rov or to a teacher. An officer of the law has religious awe attached to him. You don't interfere with that at all, ever, no matter what. Because law and religion, that's shame. And when you go home and you're mixing with your friends, or you go to the movies, or you go on holiday, then you're chom, then you act like an animal. That's fine, just enjoy yourself. Just let it all hang out and enjoy yourself. It doesn't make any difference. Just make yourself comfortable. And so they flip from one culture to another. In one day they can do it 10 times. From shame to chom, to yefes, to chom, to shame, to yefes, to chom, backwards and forwards. And that's why your best friend at home can destroy you in business and can sit next to you in shul or in church and daven with you. It's no contradiction, because they're three completely separate cultures. Hollywood is chom, and Washington is shame, and New York is yefes. That's it. Very simple, and you move from one place to the other. And that we can't do in this country for two reasons. Number one, it'll destroy us. Number two, there's too much chom. If we did that, the numbers just don't work that way. We can't function that way. So the question is there a solution for South Africa? Is there an alternative to the American model? The answer is yes, the table. All we have to figure out is what Noach did. And the Medrash tells the answer to us in the next line. When we're told that Noach was an Ish Tzadik, how did Noach achieve Tzidkus in this complex environment of shame, chom, and yefes, all living in one boat? Why is he called a Tzadik, says the Medrash? Al Shezon Briyosov Shrakudush Boruchu Nikro Tzadik. Because he sustained the creatures of the Ribbono Shel Olam. Af b'nei Noach shenichnasu b'teva v'abehem v'achai v'oifas kulam tzadikim hayim. Also the sons of Noach, they were all tzadikim. Why? Because they sustained the world of the Ribbono Shel Olam. If we can take the b'nei Chom, and we can take the b'nei Shem, and we can take the b'nei Yefes, and we can say to them, okay, Chevra, you've each got a contribution to make, and we need to utilize all your strengths. Chom, you can teach us relationships, you can teach us friendships, you can teach us openness of communication and a certain kind of an honesty in relationships. And Yefes, you can teach us uncompromising standards of efficiency. And Shame, you can teach us religious values and spiritual ideas. If we can take that all together and create a model, because the interesting thing is everybody can relate to Shame. Not everybody can relate fully to Yefes. Special kind of a culture. Not everybody can relate fully to Chom. But everybody can relate to shame, because shame creates a model. And if the three get together and they create a model, the teva, something that works, a model where each one is able to contribute to do what? To be zon briyosov shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu, to build the world, to develop the world, to sustain the world, and to realize that that is tzidkus on whatever level. That's tzidkus. When a man working in this way, working with shame and working with chom and working with yefes, goes to his business and he's being zon briyosov shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that's tzidkus he's involved in. It's not outside of his religious experience, that is his religious experience. When he does his job of work, however menial it may be, if it's serving the world of the Ribbono Shel Olam and it's helping to sustain the world of the Ribbono Shel Olam, that's tzidkus. And there's a place for shame in that tzidkus, and there's a place for chom in that tzidkus, and there's a place for yefes in that tzidkus. And if the three of them learn to interact as in the teva, not as in America, where they live on different floors, and you walk up and down, one floor belongs to shame, and one belongs to chom, and one belongs to yefes, but that in everything they do, there is an interaction governed by a model which shame has formulated for them. And within that model they're all functioning. Then there's a way that the three of them can function as tzaddikim. They can all operate together, and they can move that teva around and save the entire world, and rebuild a society which has within it the potential of being a society built on Noach who was a righteous man, an honest man, an Ish Tzadik B'Doreisov.